I had been studying this, I had been wrestling with this, and I had been trying to get a confirmation for what I thought I had once believed. And at some point I just decided, I don't have all the answers. I don't understand everything, but I know the people around me are honest and good people. And I know that some of them have had similar struggles. I'm gonna move forward. And a little bit after I made that decision, that is when things came together for me.
This week on In Good Faith, we're talking about finding purpose. In fact, that's the name of our guest book, is Purpose. Senior producer Heather Bigley in studio with me.
Hello.
Thanks, Heather. And also Josh Orton, student producer.
Hi, Steve.
And I was really interested that Sam Wilkinson combines things that some people don't think go together, which is science and religion. I wonder if we've heard that so much that we believe it, but it's not really true.
Right. Oh, and he's going to say a wonderful thing about our own perceptions in this. You need to listen for that in this episode.
Well, his book is called Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. If there's something that I can look back on my life and say what I was looking for at certain points, I didn't have the words for it always. I just wanted to find the thing to do. It was meaning. I was looking for purpose and meaning. And that, then I realized during the parts of my life when I really had that, I think were the happiest times of my life too. Yeah. Is that your experience?
Yeah. I think even if I didn't really love where I was or how I'd gotten there, if I could make it make sense for me, my daily life, this I can do well and I will do well. Yeah. That made everything better.
Especially when your purpose is not just for yourself. And I'll talk about this. But when you can find purpose in serving other people, then that brings a whole new level of meaning to my life, at least.
And the idea that we have evolved. He talks about this, evolved to serve one another, which is sort of counterintuitive to evolving to be self-sufficient.
Right. It's not survival of the fittest, necessarily.
No, no.
It's survival of the family.
And I love that he starts all of this by going into total culture shock. He goes to medical school, and then suddenly he's hit with all these questions that he has to deal with, which sets him off on this whole career and this book.
The whole book stems from an existential crisis I had when I was in medical school. I graduated. I went to school at BYU, undergrad. And within 3 months, I graduated, I got married, and we moved our family to Maryland. I grew up mostly on the East Coast, so I wasn't foreign to the East Coast. But for whatever reason at this time, as I delved into my medical studies, I really started to wrestle with what I had been taught in Sunday school versus what I was learning about evolution and what that implied. And I was bothered by some of the implication. So I undertook a several month long process where I really studied this. And without going into great detail in something that's a fairly personal experience, I came to conclusions that I didn't quite understand what I thought I did about evolution, that it in some ways was reinforcing of a sense that there is a higher purpose to our existence. I had been studying this, I had been wrestling with this, and I had been trying to get a confirmation for what I thought I had once believed. And at some point I just decided, look, I'm going to move forward. I don't have all the answers. And so it was after I kind of said, okay, I'm going to do this. I don't understand everything. Still got some questions, but I know the people around me are honest and good people. And I know that some of them have had similar struggles. I'm going to move forward. And a little bit after I made that decision, that is when things came together for me. And this is what led me to want to write the book.
So you take this leap of faith, but then you seem to sense like maybe a confirmation like, yes, yeah, this was a good path to go down.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't understand, and I mean, not that I understand anything, everything now, but this particular question about evolution and human nature and does evolution really say that we're just random accidents and that there's no purpose? And these questions, I feel like I got an answer to. I feel guided to seek, you know, sources and different references and so forth and pull this kind of framework together.
So when you actually got to medical school, Was there a pretty sharp divide? You have to have one or the other, the science or the theology, but ne'er the twain shall meet?
You know, it was probably more perceived than real. I didn't have professors say, if you believe in God or a higher purpose, then you're silly. Some professors would lay it on there kind of thick and heavy.
And you come to this really interesting place about human evolution shaping our nature to produce the strongest forms of love and affection and family relationships. Can you talk about that? Because that was really fascinating.
One of the things that initially bothered me about evolution was what it implied about human nature. And this stemmed really more from my incomplete understanding than I think what it actually says. And when we think about evolution, we sometimes think about a survival of the fittest, right? And what does that conjure? What does that bring to mind? We're selfish, aggressive, and so forth. And it's much more complex than that. And in the way that the term biologists use is natural selection, the way that natural selection has shaped human relationships, especially among family, has left the opposite tendencies. And we do have a capacity for selfishness, but we also have a capacity for altruism and love and cooperation. And much of this stems, at least the deepest forms, in the way that natural selection has shaped our family relationships. Let me just go into a little bit of the detail here. When our offspring are born, they are incredibly immature. Some scholars who study infant development refer to the first 6 months or so of life as the, quote, fourth trimester. Because we're, in a real way, we're essentially born half-baked. And probably we are the creature of all the living things. We are among the most extreme in this respect. Giraffes can walk within a day or so of being born. Horses can trot within a few days, so forth. But it takes us like 15 or so years to have the physical and even longer for the developmental maturity. And there's a psychiatrist, one of my professional heroes, named John Bowlby, who looked at this relationship and developed what's called attachment theory, in that in order for our species to thrive, we had to develop this deep love for our children. It's an evolutionary kind of mandate. And everything that a baby does, cry, coo, laugh, smile, and so forth, seems to have at least one purpose: to draw the parent close to the child. And there has to be this reciprocal deep love on the part of the parent. And most people who have been parents can identify with that. When your child is born, there's this deep love that you feel. And in our faith, at least, it's impossible to totally separate the physical from the spiritual. But some might say that's a little bit cynical, that we only love our children because they have our genes or so forth. The way I would frame it is that this is the way that God made us. God made us in such a way that we have this deep, overwhelming love for our children.
The whole idea in the very title of your book, Purpose, is really intriguing because it could be said that it's totally random development. But you argue or present at least the idea in one place that there is something leading to, what would you call it, best choices, best strategies?
What you're getting at is something else that I initially didn't like about the theory of evolution was the concept that it was just totally random, right? That life is an accident. We are essentially really intricate molecular mutations that have fortunately coalesced and accumulated over millions of years. And there's quite a bit of compelling evidence that it's not nearly as random as we once thought it was. And what you're getting at, this is a concept called convergence, where different creatures will develop the same structures over and over and over and over again. And it turns out that this is incredibly widespread. It was maybe once thought, oh, this is a one-off or two-off thing. But pretty much everything has developed or evolved more than once. In fact, Richard Dawkins, you may know his name, he is probably the most outspoken atheist of our generation. Mm-hmm. He has recognized this, and he proved this to a friend of his once at the University of Oxford, a colleague of his. He asked, can you think of any, quote, good ideas that have evolved only once? And his friend could think of a handful. So it seems that there are higher order principles that have constrained evolution to go in certain directions and not others. And so you see, it's not just a random concatenation of haphazard forms that evolve. There's a pattern to this. And there's still a lot we don't know about how did evolution or nature guide this to go in certain directions, not others. But it's pretty clear that the level of randomness is much, much less than we initially thought. There's still some randomness. So your eyes, the color of your eyes, may be a random reassortment of your parents' genes, but the fact that you have eyes and they are structured the way they are seems to be inherent in the biological principles of matter.
And I love the chart in the book where you feature side views of human eye and the eye of a squid.
Yes.
Which it seems like a common ancestor would have to be way far back.
What biologists will tell us is that we each develop this almost exact same structure independently. That common ancestor didn't necessarily have an eye, or maybe had what's sometimes called eye spots, but we each evolved these exact same structures pretty much independently. And by the way, it's not just us and squid. Biologists believe that eyes have evolved independently about 40 plus different times.
Wow.
So it's not an accident. There's kind of some principles of nature, many of which we don't understand, that seem to have constrained nature to produce certain forms over and over again.
You're listening to In Good Faith. We'll be back in just a moment with more.
I'm Stephen Cap Perry. When you talk about current events, do you ever feel like you have to tiptoe around people you know or maybe even family members because it seems like some topics are just like landmines? Can I even bring up this topic and have a civil discussion without starting a civil war within my family? Check out the podcast Top of Mind with award-winning journalist Julie Rose. Top of Mind dives into those tough topics, but it does it in a way that actually models how to have intelligent conversations, ask questions out of sincere curiosity, seeking to understand. Top of Mind is not trying to take a position and change your mind or persuade you. It is exploring. You'll come away with more empathy and clarity so that you can become a better citizen, a kinder neighbor, even family member. Listen to Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to In Good Faith. I'm speaking with Dr. Samuel Wilkinson, author of a book called Purpose. I want to get to the question of meaning. First, though, are you comfortable telling me a little bit about growing up and your faith life? What made you be someone who believed in something beyond what we can see?
I mostly grew up on the East Coast in Virginia. My family were all members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and for the most part, I grew up believing. There was a period where I was a little rebellious as a teenager, which happens to a lot of young kids around that age. But I came around, so to speak, and I went to college. I interrupted my college and served a mission, as is somewhat typical among Latter-day Saints. And there were periods along the way, once, especially when I was in high school, when I was like, do I really believe this?
Yeah.
And I did have some answers along the way. As I mentioned earlier, moved with my new wife to Maryland, to Baltimore, Maryland, to enroll in medical school. And that was the most intense period where I had to really say, look, these kind of confirmations that I had before, were they real? And I need to get a deeper answer. I need to get more. And I did, in a way that's fairly personal. I got an answer. And then I feel like I was guided to write this book.
You talk about an overarching purpose to our existence, but what that purpose might be? That's an excellent question. Would you comment even just on the question itself?
Yeah, so sorry to keep going back to this, but what was so off-putting about biology? So many of the leading thinkers in evolution would write about evolution in a way that it said, there's no purpose to life. Sorry, but this is just biology. And that's since been the party platform, really since Darwin. And I didn't like that. And what I concluded is that from a certain framework, if you look at the way that evolution has shaped us, it leaves us pulled in different directions, okay? We have immense capacity for selfishness. Right? I can't deny that. I don't think anyone who has a basic understanding of human nature and human history can deny that we do have a deep capacity for selfishness. But we also have a deep capacity for altruism. We have a deep capacity for aggression. but also cooperation. So one of the classic scenarios is you have a trucker driving through a town and they stop to eat at a diner and they leave a tip for the waiter, the waitress, even though there's no close biological connection and it's presumable that they're never going to see that person again. Why would we do this? Why is there one shot and sometimes even anonymous giving, right? We donate to children in Africa that we don't know personally through a somewhat anonymous mechanism of a charity. There's a lot of potential reasons. One, it goes back to this issue of what's called in-group and out-group bias. So this is a phenomenon in human nature where we readily identify with people who are part of our group, and we tend to have sometimes mild, sometimes very strong preferential bias towards treating those members of our group well and the people outside our group not so well. In our faith tradition, the notion is that we are all children of God. And if that's such a basic thing, you learn that as a little kid, you sing songs about it. But if you could really internalize that and keep going back to just drawing this group circle larger and larger, when you combine that with the subjective experience that all of us have, that we have free will, it makes it seem like life is a test, right? We have this freedom to choose, but nature has built within us these competing dispositions of what we in theological terms call good and evil. Hmm. And that part of our purpose here is to choose between those competing dispositions.
So do you think religious communities help us sort that out?
I definitely do. There's lots of fascinating aspects about human nature. One of them is that we are not very good at predicting what is going to make us happy. This is called affective forecasting. And there's potential reasons why that is the case. But the literature is pretty much in support of this notion that it is our relationships that make us happy, that lead to enduring and lasting happiness. But most of us, you think, oh, if I could just get this new job, or if I could just more money or more things or this shiny new car. And advertisers understand this too, as you probably realize. And so one of the reasons that I go to church is because it constantly reminds me what is important, because we often forget. So you have these large surveys by the Pew Foundation and so forth. What is it that makes life most meaningful? What is it that gets you up in the morning? For most people, more than work, about twice as often, people will respond with their relationships, with family in particular, children, and so forth. So when you ask people what gives life meaning, the most common answer is our relationships, and in particular, our family relationships. And that's hard for some people because not everyone comes from a great, wonderful, loving family. And there is a profound unfairness in life. What I wish that we could do better as a society is help government and policymakers and so forth, help them recognize and structure social groups in such a way that we can continually remind ourselves of this, because we do forget. When I wake up in the morning, to my detriment, I'm not often thinking, okay, how can I make my relationships better? And when we are focused on our relationships, the better aspects of our nature tend to predominate. Right? It's a function of the way we were created.
Do you happen to be a parent?
I do. I am. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, in your own little step in passing on the genes in the wide universe, what has that taught you about God?
I remember reading scripture. I was an undergraduate, not yet married, not yet having children. And I was reading this specific part of scripture, this period where Jesus is ministering among some of the people. And I was reading it at that time, and I had a question. I said, I want to read with the thought in mind, how does Jesus feel towards the people that he's helping? And I didn't get very far, and I realized I'm not going to be able to understand in full measure the depth of his feeling and so forth until I have children. In our faith, we refer to God as our Father in heaven. And I think that is just so real, and the amount of love that we have for our children is a really good glimpse as to what the love of God is for us. I do think that relationship is a very real one in terms of a child-parent relationship.
There is a scripture in the Latter-day Saint tradition that says that we should, quote, seek learning, even study, and also by faith. So that sounds like combining whatever we can learn through scientific method, through reading what other people have researched, as well as mixing in this element of something that, what would you call it? A different way of perceiving the universe and life?
I was just talking with someone about this, someone who's not necessarily a believer, and we were having a disagreement here in how we thought about truth. I believe that truth is self-consistent and that there's at least two ways to discover truth. One through science and the other is through, we call it revelation. And the scientific method is broadly regarded, and there's generally a consensus on there's better and worse ways to quote, do science. Revelation is tricky, but in both of them, there is a kind of provisional aspect to them, right? And at least in what I love about my faith is that there is a provisional aspect to the revelation part, that we're open to new knowledge and new frameworks of looking at things. And it's not like God has spoken and there's never going to be anything more that we are told from God. And science is very much like that in that it's always provisional. There's always going to be new learning and understanding that unfolds as we progress in this process.
Whether faith or science, we have to be ready to change our ideas and our understanding as new information comes in.
Yes. Another part where I think there's a similarity is, and again, this is something I'm grateful for in my own faith tradition, is the opportunity to ask questions. That the best science is centered on a key question. Okay, you have this question and you design an experiment to answer it. And there's a method, and there's better methods and there's worse methods. And if you don't use great methods, you're not necessarily going to get the right answer. And there's a lot of similarity, at least in my experience and my understanding of how we might get answers to questions that science can't yet answer. Things like, what is the purpose of life and so forth. And there are questions and there are methods too. And if you don't use the methods right, you're not going to necessarily get the proper answer.
What are the things that you feel that help you feel connected to God, whether it's personal practice or relationships, whatever it might be, or your work even?
I think it's mostly in relationships, mostly in serving other people. That, and there's lots of data from psychology, other social science, that not necessarily asking about a connection to God, but asking about a connection to joy and being and happiness. Mm-hmm. There is this counterintuitive aspect to our natures that when we are embedded in something that is bigger than us, that is more important than us, that's when we feel great meaning and joy. And serving others, connecting with other people, for me, that's when I most often feel the hand of God in my life in some way, saying, this is what you should be doing. It's not about you. It's about you connecting and helping other people.
You start the book with the first chapter, Science, Religion, and the Meaninglessness of Existence. And then you end with The Good Life, The Good Society, and a chapter called Final Thoughts. So any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that so often today, there's a tendency to view people as either all good or all bad. And I think that's a mistake, and it can lead to some dangerous ideas. I think we need to have patience with ourselves, with each other. Every person is a mix of strengths and weaknesses. And the purpose of life, as I see it, is not to point out the weaknesses in your spouse, your neighbor, even your political opponent, but to point out the weaknesses in yourself and to, as much as you can, overcome them, to accentuate your strengths and to overcome your weaknesses. That is what I see as one of the fundamental purposes of our existence.
That was Steve talking to Dr. Samuel Wilkinson of Yale. One of the things that I really appreciated that Dr. Wilkinson was talking about was that we should view everybody as a child of God. I think one of the things I've been studying in school, I'm a political science major, is that there's this thing called affective polarization, where because like partisanship matters so much to people, they begin to adopt that really as their identity more than anything else. And then they see other people the out-group as just the enemy. Mm. But if we, rather than doing this, see people as children of God, it kind of eliminates that out-group bias. We just see them as our brothers and sisters. We see them as people that we can love and serve. And sure, they're going to make mistakes, and sure, they don't believe the same things that we believe, but we can still kind of coexist and even serve and love one another. I think that's super important, especially this election year, right? There's a lot of negativity. But if we switch how we see people and see them as children of God, I think that can really help us and benefit us.
Also, that people's greatest happiness in his research seems to come from when they do serve each other and when they do build some sort of connection and community. I heard that word connection so many times.
I just love this thing where he said, I don't wake up in the morning thinking, how can I improve my relationships better today? And I thought, oh, but golly, what if we did, right? And I think he was pointing us in that direction. And I just, you know, I thought, if I woke up and if that were part of my prayer life, how will I make my relationship with my husband better or the relationship I have with my mother? I just felt really strongly like this is something we could all use, but especially you, Heather Bigley. And I was thankful to hear that from him.
Amen.
Josh, I love what you said. He decided, I'm uncomfortable with this. I should lean into it.
Right.
May we all learn to do that better.
The other thing that I loved about this discussion is it's a discussion of how do we discover truth.
Yeah.
And recently I had a former student call me and literally ask me that question. Dr. Bigley, how do we know what's true? And I've never been so humbled in my life. And we talked about it for a while, right? And hearing from her, her own experience with searching for truth. And I don't think she identifies as a religious person at all. But this idea that we're looking for meaning, we're looking for purpose, but we're also, we want to know that the path we're on is good. I think that's really what we're asking. How do we know what is good? And I think if we can just share with each other how we know those things, that's maybe one way to better those relationships.
Many thanks to Sam Wilkinson for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Leah King, Katarina Martinich, Josh Orton, and Ashton Rowan. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Daniel Phillips, and Ashton Parkinson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. If you like what we do here at In Good Faith, we hope you'll spread the word. Give us a good review wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Find us on Twitter at In Good Faith Pod, on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast, and the YouTube channel, where you'll see some extras and extended interviews, youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.